A65. Number 26A.
So we go on with synonymous term truth, and we come to the level of Christian Science. And again, we can see how truth first comes to us and touches us. For instance, Mrs. Eddy speaks a lot about the voice of truth, and naturally the voice of truth would not be a true symbol for the first three categories, because only we hear God speak. God doesn't speak to itself. So it comes first as that still, small voice of truth, and sometimes comes like a trumpet blow of truth, or as the lion roars, comes as a truth. But still, somehow within our consciousness, something is being touched and awakened. This truth comes to us as revelation, for instance. You see, a revelation cannot be on the level of the first three categories. Revelation is only revealing itself to the human. So it comes to us as a revelation. It comes to us as very faultless. Truth can only speak the truth, small t. And that is how it comes to us, in an unerring, faultless way. So you have faultless, unerring. Truth comes as the voice of truth and tells us through the revelation something that is true. So it establishes within us something that is true. It establishes within us an idea, a true idea that comes to us. And therefore also comes to us through that true idea as a true solution for a problem. Truth solves the problem. Truth also, in its whole power, comes to us as being very effectual. We experience it as a very effectual truth because it gives us dominion. So again, we could say, well, dominion, the sixth day of creation, is nothing that could be put in category 1, 2, or 3, because truth does not need to have dominion, because dominion always means dominion over. So we can see that truth here comes as dominion, touches us as a true sense of manhood, because the compound idea in category 3 now translates itself to us and says, what is that compound idea? That compound idea is actually true manhood, namely the manhood of ideas. It gives us a sense that we are the heir of God, the ideal man. It gives us the rights of man. We feel here that we all get those true rights, the man rights that we have. Naturally comes to us as health, never as sickness, comes to us as wholeness. So again, you can see how that term whole and wholeness, we had it first in the first category, that truth is wholeness as such, or the whole, sorry, not wholeness as such, but the whole, in its own realm, it becomes, in the second category, wholeness. And that wholeness is actually then shown as in the category 3 as a compound idea, where an idea is compound and is whole. It's a whole idea. And then, whereas in category 4, that whole idea comes to us as a sense of health or wholeness. Health means that we are whole, but health applies only to the human. Truth comes to us also as divine justice. I always like that I always feel in human relationship, we have a lot to do with justice and with judges and what is right and what is justified. what is righteous. So I always feel no matter what's going on in the world, what human righteousness is, I don't care about it. You remember how it is said, I think, in Psalms or somewhere, that human righteousness is like a filthy rag. And that's that way. And when we think about Paul, his whole letter to the Romans started out with a long, long exposition about the righteousness that is before God, and that the righteousness which is before God only matters, and that human righteousness doesn't matter. And one gets quite a different feel of what is divine justice compared with human justice. And I think we must get a new sense of justice in this world where everything is so corrupt and so unjust that we are not dragged down by human righteousness, and really lift our head above it and see that we are living in a completely different universe, in an universe of justice where truth is justice. And not people are just, and that we don't demand justice from people. I always don't care about human justice. I always feel truth is the divine judge, and I must be right before truth. So this is the way it comes to us, and naturally, when it touches the opposite, then in category 5 we really get those aspects of truth which are predominant usually in our consciousness when we think about the synonymous term. It's all about how it comes to error and what it does to error. And actually you have here a complete long list, but they all mean the same. I just took as many renderings from the textbook as possible, because through the quantity of the renderings, which all have the same quality, you really see that a divine quantity then becomes a divine quality. So here we have, what does truth do to its suppositional opposite? Now we have, it unveils error first, then it uncovers error, then it neutralizes error. How does it neutralize error? By working out the nothingness of error. How can it work out the nothingness of error? By truth destroying error, dispelling error, depriving error, annihilating error, removes error, obliterates error, consumes error, swallows up error, overcomes error, conquers error, wipes out error, quenches error. These are some of the renderings that the textbook uses, and you just can hear that important tonality, that truth destroys error and thereby sets man free. Therefore here truth is shown as the victor. Can you see that belongs to this category? It is therefore the victor, therefore it is the redeemer, it's the savior. It's the universal remedy. Yes. This is a simple tonality here. But you can somehow... Now, let's go further and then repeat. Well, what does it do if truth destroys error within our consciousness? Then naturally our consciousness has no more so much error within itself. I say so much because it's a step-by-step process, and it takes a lifetime or even longer, really, to get rid of error. So what does it build up within ourselves, establish within ourselves? It establishes within ourselves, for instance, the desire to adhere to truth, as adherents of truth. We claim truth. We begin to be an adherent, we begin to claim truth, to accept truth, to affirm truth within ourselves. So it gives us a sense of dominion by adhering to truth, because we know we have the stronger partner than error. It gives a sense of dominion. So here you could see that we have the term dominion in category 6, but we also had it in category 4. But in category 4, it was that we receive a sense of dominion from the higher levels, but now it raises up within ourselves a sense that we actually have dominion. First, it only gives us the idea of dominion. That dominion then in the category 5 destroys error and shows that it has dominion, that it proves to have dominion. And so then in category 6 we feel that sense of having dominion. It is a sense of dominion through what? Through affirmation of truth, through denial of error. Here we have the old practice of affirming and denying. That comes here. It raises up in us the sense that we have to claim error, not only to affirm error, to claim truth for us, that we have to utilize the power of truth, or else we wouldn't claim it if we wouldn't utilize it. It raises within us the sense of being righteous. See, that righteousness is now being righteous. Perhaps it would have been better if I had said being righteous, because righteousness was coming to us as the divine righteousness in column 4 by the divine justice. But through that, somehow we have a better sense or a diviner sense of what is right and what is wrong, which is very different from the human sense of right and wrong, or from a moral sense of right and wrong. The spiritual sense of righteousness is a completely different sense. That's why we should never really judge something as being righteous or not righteous from a moral level. It never works. It's all falls short of a true standard. Through that righteousness, something in us comes to the point of being upright, because we feel the power of truth on our side. We feel that error cannot destroy that truth. So one feels within oneself the power of right, of uprightness, of truthfulness. And naturally, the sixth beatitude, blessed are the pure in heart, the purity in heart, which is purity in consciousness, a pure human consciousness, and the sincerity that goes with it. So this column 6 all has to do actually with the uprightness of manhood, the human uprightness, the human truthfulness of manhood, that is able to affirm and claim what is true and to deny that which is not right and not upright. The last column, if we can do that quickly, we know it now. All in the last column we always get the noumenon evil, or the noumenon counterfeit of the synonymous term of truth. The counterfeit is error, falsity, a lie, falsehood, the denial of truth. Truth that is whole, knows no contradiction, no sickness, the wholeness of truth, knows no sickness, no antichrist. And if we try to take that aspect of a theism, that would depict really the counterfeit of truth. Truth we have seen here is the righteousness of truth, the right government of truth, a sense of deity that is always right. Well, the counterfeit of it is actually the theodicy. Theodicy, Mrs. Eddy uses that term too. It is, Dennis, would you know, is it from Kant or is it from Leibniz? I think Leibniz, huh?
The theological justification for the existence of evil.
Yes, but who invented the term? Was it Leibniz or Kant? I think it was Leibniz. That the theodicy is a statement that God... please repeat it loud.
It's the theological justification for the existence of evil.
Yeah. So it's a justification that God can do evil and that there is error, or that also it is interpreted in this way, that the world as it is, with truth and error, is the best world that can be. That's another definition of the theodicy. You see, it's taking in the factuality of error, and that error is not as bad as we think it is, that it is under the present condition the best that could be done.
That was Leibniz.
That was Leibniz. Yeah. Thank you. So, you can see here the real theism of truth would only say there is only truth, and there is no error, and there is nothing good in error. Only that which is truth, capital T, is any good, and therefore we must get rid of error. But again, going through that whole list, my old war cry, I repeat it, and I will repeat it another time when you go through love, just don't forget, there are not counterfeits. They are these terms, these negative terms, are no entity by themselves. They are not something beside God. If they are not beside God, they are in God. And they are just a certain category within truth, namely the category of misunderstanding, the non-science category. Yes, Frank?
I notice here in the outline of truth, we don't have Christ.
Yes, we could put in there, in where? Where would you put it in?
Well, I was thinking about that.
Yes, good.
And I'm stuck between one and two.
Yes, well, it would be, now if you remember our chart, the levels, where does Christ come in for the first time in the chart?
Would it not be the relationship to idea?
Yes, sure. Therefore?
It would be three. It would be three here.
If you define Christ as a relationship, say, as the agreement between God and man, but as coexistence, then naturally it is divine sign. You see, I ask you, where on the chart does Christ appear for the first time? Well, we don't have on the level of science itself, we don't have word Christ, Christianity and science. But when it's related to the divine science level, there for the first time you have word Christ. And you remember in the survey we have taken then, we have seen that in the survey that Christ on divine science is called truth itself. It's not so much the Christ as we have it on the lower level, as a translation. So you could put it in category 2 next to Son capitalized, because that's the synonymous term. Son capitalized is the Christ. Okay, so still, just let us try to flow through those seven categories again quickly in order to be able somehow to establish what truth is, that we feel first truth is the divine self-consciousness of itself, of what exists, being conscious of life, being conscious of its beingness. And therefore, in the field and the realm, come to two, in the realm of that truth would always consciously affirm and accept or affirm and claim what is. The claiming of the isnessness of being, small b. When it comes to the point of absolute Christian science, then we would see that it is the truth about all the truths. That it includes all the truths and therefore calculates always each specific truth. That truth is that which can calculate everything, the specific truth, it's the calculus of the compound idea. Then from that point we have the great step over to the human, and we see, well, that truth comes to us as a truth, a true consciousness. It comes to us really as the voice of truth that begins to reveal something true, something new, and comes to us in a true way, in an unerring way, in a sense that it establishes a solution, that it begins to introduce a solution, where we see, oh, it goes this way. It's really that which shows the truth about everything, even in the human, a true sense of manhood, and that begins to destroy error. So you have the category of five, that truth begins to analyze, uncover, and then annihilate error, and so truth becomes the victor. You really see truth over error, truth destroying error. And that builds up within ourselves a more truthful attitude, a more righteous attitude, a more truthful attitude, a more truth-affirming attitude. And so gives us a higher sense of dominion. So that shows that there is no error. That error is just a misunderstanding of what we have been doing in category 1 to 6. Well, that brings us to the last synonymous term, love. Quite a big subject. Again, we can ask ourselves, what is the inner nature of love as such? Again, we would say, perhaps at once, well, love shows the perfection of being. We would see, starting with life, that life says, I'm the isness of being. Truth says, I'm conscious of the isness of being. And love would say, I'm conscious of the perfection of being, or I'm conscious of that being in its perfection. Everything is at the point of perfection, of self-sufficiency, of integrated being. Everything is there. But then we really come to the warmer sense of love, the moment we translate it to the realm of love, to divine science, category 2, where we feel that that perfection of being is now the mother of the universe. And we get the biblical term of mothering, mothering sense of the universe. That mothering sense of the universe is always showing that the mother bears the child, that the mother has the child within itself. That it bears the child, that it embraces the child, that it hugs the child, that the child is with the mother. And so we have that it is one, that love is one with its creation, that is never without its full manifestation. Here you get those wonderful tones of love, which just says the mother includes the child, therefore where there is God, there is idea. Therefore, it's never without its manifestation, it's never without its universe that is at the point of perfection, it never loses sight of loveliness, never loses that sight, always sees its own realm in the light of love, in the light of perfection, in the light of holiness. It's therefore an infinite self-containment that mother contains with itself the manifestation of the child, of the idea. It's not separate from it, it's coexistent with it. Therefore it gives the sense that love is embracing its realm, its universe. Therefore love is universal, is all-encompassing. You have a sense of totality of love, of the completeness of love, and the plan of love. That everything within that universe has its proper place within a big plan, and has already found its place value. So we really get a realm sense of love, where love and love's idea wedded. It's the bride and the lamb wedded. See, love wedded to its own idea. That's the way Apocalypse brings it out. I always feel if you want to get a high sense of the synonymous term love, you just have to go through those few not few, there are quite a lot of references on love in Apocalypse, because there you find, so to say, always the climax of the term love. There we see, the tone of love, you see even where she says that love is the law of compensation, really, for everything that presents itself as evil, that just love just never loses sight of loveliness, that it is constantly wedded to its idea. Love is therefore that attitude here which says, I can never see anything but in its perfect state. How long does it take us to have that attitude? It's easy. I can never say to these high facts it's difficult, because they are so simple. What makes it difficult is our inconsistency. That's all. Our misapprehending it. It's the last column that makes it difficult, but not the subject itself. The subject itself is clear to us, very clear. That love says, I never lose sight of loveliness. I never lose sight of a universe that is perfect. Nobody can hinder us that. It's not difficult. It's just that you are not consistent. And this is, I think, the life practice. Life practice, that we are put under the stress of circumstances to deviate from our ideal. That's really what we have to work out, that those simple facts are held consistently in our consciousness, and that no testimony of the physical sense and so on can sidetrack us, that no human sense of justice and righteousness can sidetrack that. That's the problem.